Did you watch UFC this weekend?
I did. Ryan came over, actually.
You should probably explain that that's not me.
The Ryan. Other Ryan. The Ryan that I cheat on this Ryan with. Ryan did not come over. Ryan came over.
I did not watch it, but I heard there was like big controversy. So it's one of the things I wanted to ask you about because I know you watch them.
Yeah, Max Holloway fight. It was like the second title bout. There was like three title bouts. We were kind of half paying attention, had a few whiskeys, you know, and nice. We were playing a little Mario Kart. And then we started watching the fight. I showed him Last of Us 2 as well. That was fun. Joe Rogan had a live stream commentary going while the fight was going, which was kind of fun. So you can pull up Joe Rogan live on YouTube because he wasn't there. And he was basically doing a talk along with like Joey Diaz and like one other person who was there. And basically, like, you know, they have the timestamp of the fight. So, you know, you're watching the same time as they are. And it's pretty cool. It was actually pretty cool.
That's really cool. I've always wanted that for like NBA games because the NBA announcers on ESPN are they're just the most boring people in the world. And they have to be, right? Because there's just such a wide audience.
But right. They're catering to the lowest denominator.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. But you want a specialized insider.
Yeah.
As a fan.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, super cool because Joe will say the kinds of things that he does when he's officiating or commentating. And the commentators there are good too. But it's just cool to hear Joe, you know, the kind of, it'd be like if you were just at a bar with him, what he would say about it, you know. But yeah, like the second fight was like controversial. It seemed like it was going the other way, 3-2, but it went 2-3. The other guy, I can't remember who it was, but the guy who beat Max Holloway, Voronofsky, this like small, shorter Russian guy. I think he's Russian. But they went all five rounds and, you know, it's a decision. And yeah.
So is it like boxing where you don't know if you've won the round until?
Yeah, every round gets scored. The winner gets 10 points. And then the other person usually gets 9 points. Sometimes they get 8 if they just got decimated the whole time. Usually doesn't happen. And then sometimes they also get 10, basically, if it's even, which doesn't happen a lot either. So that's why in a normal match, when there's three rounds, you'll hear like, Conor McGregor wins 30-27, like unanimous 30-27. Meaning he got 10 points all three rounds. The other person got 9 points all three rounds.
Gotcha.
So 30-27 is like perfect win, or like you won all three rounds. And it's unanimous because there's three judges. So sometimes it'll be like split decision, 30-29, you know, or 29-28, 28-29, something like that. And then the final judge determines it or whatever. And so usually, you know, like usually they show the hits at the end of each round and like significant strikes. And so I'm trying to remember exactly how it went. There's some whiskey between then and now. But basically, it was like Voronofsky won. Is that his name? I feel like that's a mathematician. I'm getting it. Max Holloway, Alexander. Yeah, Volkanovski. Voronofsky is like. Voronoff is a maybe I don't even know. Something weird about a Russian doctor. Volkanovski. I think like he won the first one, then Max won, and then the third round was the one that everyone thought like Max won, but he ended up winning. He got like a big takedown at the end, and so anyways, he ended up winning, but it seemed like Max had it. So that was like the controversy. It was pretty good fights overall though. Nothing like super exciting, you know. It's always more fun when there's like a really exciting thing, but it was still interesting. It was still fun.
Huh, cool.
I mean, it's like I'm not even like that much of a sports person, man, and I'm like desperate for sports these days because I just didn't realize how much I had become part of my life of just like going to a bar and watching a basketball game that I like as a nice break and get around people. It's a social thing, you know, and
yeah,
like,
oh yeah,
there's just like none of that now, and it just is so, it's brutal.
NBA is starting up. They're all in Orlando right now.
That's so funny. They're
calling it the bubble, so they're all just stuck in Disney
for my gosh,
for the next, you know, 2.5 months, 3 months.
That's funny.
So wow. I'm excited. It starts probably about 2 weeks. It's like July 29th.
Nice. So, that's coming up.
I am pretty pumped for that. Yeah. I've also very much missed sports. So.
Yeah. I wonder if we'll be able to watch it at a bar, like if they'll have TVs on the sidewalks.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Put like a projector outside.
I bet they will, man. I bet they will. New Yorkers find a way. Dude, I was walking around my neighborhood the other night and it was like, it was raining. I wanted to take a video. It was like the instant monsoon that's been happening where it just like comes out and people are eating their. I'm walking by Isotti where they have this lasagna that I know is like $40 and incredible. And it's like getting rained on. The person's like bringing an umbrella, like the waiter's bringing an umbrella over. I'm like, New Yorkers find a way, man. You're not going to stop them from eating that lasagna. No matter if they have to eat it on a sidewalk, they have to eat it in the middle of a summer thunderstorm. Like they don't care. They're going to get out of their house and eat out. You know, it's just funny.
Nice.
But yeah, the city is definitely coming back alive. So that was nice. Man, I was listening to this podcast and I heard it was copy paste repeat with Brandon Hayes and Chris Freeman, and they were talking about Stop Energy, and I was like, man, that's like a Ryan Toronto his name all over it. And I was wondering if you had heard of this.
I have never heard of this. I actually wanted to, when you put it in podcast topics, I wanted to ask you, like, is this a new JavaScript framework? What is this? But I figured we'd wait.
So RFC, what is Stop Energy? Posted by Dave Weiner in 2002, April of 2002. I don't know exactly what this guy does, but he says, this is one of those terms I've been using casually, and it's time to try to write a definition. Suppose someone, call him Mr. A, has an idea that he believes is ready to deploy or is requesting comments as he's getting ready to deploy. So he posts an RFC, usually on a mail list or a website, in the hope that people will spot a problem and help him figure out a solution, or find no problems and co-develop an implementation, or develop a compatible implementation. In theory, the internet is a collegial environment with lots of people who want to do new stuff where one should expect to get this kind of help. In this scenario, A is a proponent of forward motion. In all likelihood, instead of getting help, A will encounter stop energy, reasons why he can't or shouldn't be allowed to do what he proposes. Stop energy is not reasoned. It never takes into account the big picture. It is the mirror image of forward motion. In the stop energy model, everyone, no matter how small their stake in a technology, has the power to veto. Nothing ever gets done, and people who want to move forward are frustrated in every attempt to move. Unfortunately, stop energy is the rule, not the exception. In my experience, forward motion only happens when no one else is interested enough to mount a stop energy campaign, or if the proponent of forward motion simply ignores the stop energy. And stop energy can be applied retroactively. I heard at a working group meeting that things like SOAP can only happen when no one is paying attention. I pointed out that XML RPC happened exactly that way and suggested that they use it. The point went without response. Stop energy trumps forward motion every time, it seems. I've been suckered into debates with stop energy proponents too many times. These days, I don't propose open protocols or formats unless there is a clear advantage to being open, because I want to move and I'm tired of pointless debates. Just for fun, I decided to make this an RFC.
That's great. I mean, as you were reading that, I was thinking of Ember RFCs, and I would say probably 8 out of 10 times I comment, it is one of those stop energy comments, and I feel like super guilty right now after hearing you say that.
Super called out when I heard this got read, right? Yeah. And so, yeah, basically Brandon and Chris like spent half the episode talking about this, so I'm just kind of shamelessly ripping the idea, but I thought this was such a good thing, and I was like, we're definitely going to have some thoughts here. And dude, it's like not even just, I mean, the RFC and Ember, or really more generally like the open source that we've worked on in the past, is like the easiest thing to connect this to, but it goes to like so many things, man. Decision making by committee within companies.
Yes.
There's so many things here, right?
I mean, we've all been on that team meeting with like 30 people, and you ask for comments, and someone that just doesn't care about anything that you're doing speaks up. And
yeah.
It's just, yeah.
So, yeah. Brandon brought up some interesting points and said, you know, a lot of times the reason you have guards in place to stop forward motion is because forward motion, you know, with no consideration can cause problems. So he's kind of saying like, move fast and break things doesn't always work. Like you actually want a balance there. There's a cost to that. Chris's kind of rebuttal there was like, he doesn't think that this is what this is talking about. He was saying that this part where it says stop energy is not reasoned. It never takes into account the big picture. It is the mirror image of forward motion. In the stop energy model, everyone, no matter how small their stake in a technology, has the power to veto. Yeah. So that's the thing where it's kind of like, it's one thing to talk about bureaucracy as a tool for putting up safeguards because maybe in the past too much motion has caused problems, right? But it's another to say, the example they kept using in the podcast was like, you know, I like at you in like a single line of a PR that you opened up and say like at Ryan thoughts question mark. And like, I haven't considered really anything. It's actually like putting a huge burden on you to like read this thing, get the context for it, and then come up with a response. And I haven't even considered all of that stuff.
Yeah. It's also like when have we ever been right about that sort of stuff? I feel like I can, if you at me with thoughts, I can write up paragraphs, but then after I use the thing for 3 months, what I originally wrote and what I would write 3 months later they would be completely different.
Totally. Yeah, it's just interesting. And it definitely made, the discussion definitely made me think of like, well, yeah. So the one example, you know, I think with the Ember RFCs, I mean, that's easy to pick on, right? But I think recently they've been better about like the core steering committee, what they call themselves, is like, we are taking it as input, but we are going to decide. That's kind of in theory how they like are doing it these days, as opposed to before, where it felt like it was much more trying to make everyone happy, which is like a disaster plan, right? Mm-hmm.
It's are you looking for comments for why we shouldn't do this, or is this more of a we're trying to expose our process early?
Yeah,
and you can comment, but we're not going to listen.
Yep, and we've seen like the React community is like kind of going through some of the same growing pains. I saw Dan Abramov tweeting about his frustration with trying to be open about suspense and feeling like there's just a lot of, you know, the people who are noisy about it are like cutting the team down or bringing up concerns. And it has a similar feel to this stop energy. And the way they responded was basically just to completely stop talking about it. I mean, they just completely stopped talking about it because they were like, this is not productive at all. And we want to keep forward motion, what forward motion we have. And like, this is too much. So I thought that was interesting. And I think Evan had something similar happen with the Vue 3 stuff.
You know, what's funny about this is like, when I hear Dan say that, my immediate thought is like, just ignore those people.
Yeah, mine just too.
But if I were in Dan's shoes, I would feel like shit. I mean, I would feel just like, what is the point of this? Why am I doing this? And so it's one of those situations where it's like really easy to give advice, but it's really hard to know what to do.
Totally, man. Totally. Totally. One little tweet, one little comment on a video can just make you question everything. But So, and then it also made me think of like, in the past how I've done this. Certainly people have had thoughts about working on Mirage or things to add to other projects that I've worked on. And just by virtue of, let's say, me being the person who started the project or who maintains it, you know, your words or your thoughts have a huge impact on people's momentum and forward motion. And if you say, like, I think we shouldn't necessarily do this or whatever, you can just kill a lot of that forward motion very easily. So I think I'm sure probably everyone can relate to times when they've had that stop energy. And it hasn't been good. It hasn't been reasoned, disciplined thought about, you know, it's just, everyone having the power to veto is interesting. Like, who are the stakeholders here? I think that is also something that the Ember team learned. And I think that, you know, that we'll see the other folks in Vue and React. You know, Rust is doing, does RFC stuff. I think that's where Ember got it. You learn to segregate the input groups of, from different people based on who they are. And yeah, an egg profile on Twitter, you know, someone who is just has the default egg profile or whatever it used to be, is shouldn't have as much impact, right?
Right.
So that was pretty interesting too. But yeah, man, definitely in companies that we've been on before, you know, or in consulting situations, bringing up that question of like, who has thoughts about this, you know, asking for open comments, doing things in the open like this. I mean, it's tricky, right? Because a lot of the things that like the Basecamp people talk about, it's like balancing like the why was and I consulted versus like this, a lot of stuff that the Basecamp people talk about, which is like, yeah, not keeping, like making sure the people who have to think, who are the stakeholders, who actually have a stake in it, are the ones shaping the work. And then, you know,
yeah,
all that good split of work.
Why was I consulted versus designed by committee?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You know, I wonder if there's a way you can, like, open source is really good because anyone can do open source. Anyone can create a new project on GitHub and no one is forced to use an open source project, right? So it kind of balances these two things where, if someone creates a new open source JavaScript framework, you're not going to go in there and try to stop it because no one's forcing you to use it. You know what I'm saying? So
yeah.
I wonder if there's a way, like, you know, I just think of like my time on like some bigger teams. It's like, okay, we're going to roll out a new API. Everyone in the company is forced to use this new API, and it kind of creates that stop energy situation.
Yes.
So I wonder if there's a way where you can make that process more natural where it's, okay, we're rolling out a new API. You don't have to use it, and you kind of know that you failed if, you know, a year later no one's using it.
That's
I know that people don't, you know, engineering managers don't like this because they want, you know, nice clean boxes around everything and clean corners. So
I think that's a great point, and that's something that they brought up too, which was like, yeah, the way stop energy can manifest in a PR is like, yeah, these thoughts or like just, oh, I think it should be like this, and it's like, you just by saying something that actually wasn't important, you said something on the PR, you didn't improve it, so it's blocked from being merged, and you said something that really wasn't significant, right? It was really wasn't material. It might have not been certainly like a little linting thing, whatever, there's tools for that, but this is like somewhere in between linting and like a material piece of feedback that stops it because of, oh, have you thought about this or something like that, right? And now the person, you just cost like 8 hours of like back and forth and merging it and deploys because of that little comment. And like, that was another point that he kept bringing up, Chris.
Yeah. Dude, that's so great.
We've all been there, right?
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
I think the one that you brought about the company though is interesting where, yeah, it's tempting to want things in a box, but the reality is, it's like you said, the comment you would leave would change so much after usage of 3 years or 3 months or whatever. So better to get stuff out and like have like faster feedback cycle than trying to design too much up front.
Yeah.
There was something else I wanted to say, but my brain's fuzzy today. there was one other point I wanted to make. You said about, I can't remember. Anyways. So pretty interesting and definitely like, I think this thing about, these days, I don't propose open protocols or formats unless there's a clear advantage to being open. I think that's pretty interesting, you know, as a conclusion. It's kind of like, it's almost like the ideal is kind of what you were saying, which is do things in the open and just ignore the haters, right? Because, you know, there'll be people who benefit, but it's really hard.
You know, think of all the tools that I use these days. I think if you had asked me about them, JSX, GraphQL, before I started using them, I would have had comments that would have just been so off. And I would not have understood how much the parts that I enjoy them, I would not have understood that just reading yeah. RFC.
Yeah.
So I'm fine. I'm fine with frameworks developing in private.
Yeah.
And yeah, it doesn't.
I think a lot of this is really about like communication too, right? It's really like get good at communication. That's like really what I think a lot of this boils down to. And, you know, we've talked about this before on like stale repos that we used to maintain, like you're either in or out, right? And it's like, we're working on Mirage. So like we have this website going and I was thinking about like, it'd be nice to have like a change log up there and, you know, all this stuff that we want to do. And it's like, you're either doing it or you're not. And it's like, if we stopped working on Mirage, I would want to just like shut it all down because leaving it up in a half done state is like such a bad form of communication. It's just not good, right? It's like, so I think that's part of it too, is just getting better at communicating. And I think as a community, we're like learning what that actually means with these open source projects. But a lot of times maybe open source projects should have, oh, this is my experiment and it's just for myself and I'm not gonna take any PRs or issues. Feel free to use it. You know, just being more clear about stuff.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people don't, you know, everyone that starts a new open source project is just trying to scratch an itch. You wouldn't want to say up front, oh, this is just for myself. Like maybe some other people will find it helpful and maybe some people will get really excited about this.
Yeah.
So there's like,
I guess it's more like with the Vue stuff and the React stuff where they're just getting chewed out. It's like, maybe there's a better way to explain up front what the story is and set the expectations so that people don't get so pissy, you know, when this new API comes out. I don't know. Maybe people always get pissy. So,
yeah, I mean, I used to be one of those people that would get, you know, pissy about APIs, but when Hooks came out, I didn't care. Like I had no dog in that fight.
Yeah.
And I've enjoyed using it. And I know a lot of people will, you know, subtweet and shit on Hooks.
Yeah.
And say, you know, it was just dumped on us, blah, blah, blah. But
yeah,
I like it. I enjoy it. And yeah.
Yeah. So you're saying maybe there's nothing that they could have done differently, really?
Yeah. I guess what I'm saying is I think there's a lot of people out there that they're just going to be quiet and silent and they're just going to follow what you do. And they're going to look to you for advice. And that's how right. I feel about Hooks. And yeah, had they asked me about Hooks, I'm sure I could have left 50 comments and they all would have been incredibly stupid. and seriously, I'm happy with them saying like, look, we've been thinking about this and we want to experiment with it and we think you'll like it.
Yeah.
I'm happy to use it. I'm not. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe I'm just like getting old and less, you know,
persnickety or something.
Yeah but it's
usually people get more persnickety when they get older.
Yeah, more grumpy now. Yeah. I'm just like, just tell me what API to use and I'll tell you in, you know, a couple months if I like it or not.
Right But that's interesting. But yeah, basically I think there's a lot of different threads here, but I think overall, like, yeah, thinking about what you're doing when you comment on a coworker's PR or on an open source issue, if you haven't put enough thought, if you haven't given it more than 8 seconds of thought, you really should maybe hold back.
Yeah. You know, what's interesting is, as you're saying that, is a lot of times teams will say, okay, we want to do code reviews. And then they just say, okay, we're going to open PRs and everyone do code reviews. And that's usually it. That's usually like, that's the mandate stops there.
Yeah.
And no one's really thinking about this, right? There's no discussion of stop energy or...
Yeah, yeah, totally. So. Yep, there's a huge... Yeah, exactly. Like, are you starting code reviews because of a response to something? There's bad code getting merged into master or something like that. That's one thing. It's another thing to just do that and then not consider the opportunity cost. I mean, basically, that's what this is saying, right? There's opportunity cost here. There's trade-offs. And... yeah, man, like forward motion and momentum is just huge in software and iteration. And it's just huge. Even the last few weeks of our work, you know, fighting off small projects and keeping things moving is just super, super important. So yeah, pretty interesting little blog post from almost 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Not sure how much we've learned in 20 years in open source, but I thought that was a nice little tidbit.
Dude, maybe, man, going back to like the advice that I give versus how I live, but like maybe open source maintainers are just too sensitive. Like, you think Elon Musk would stop sending rockets to Mars or?
No, but see, this is what I was saying though. Because you were saying like not every open source person should have to think about this. They're just putting something out there. That's true, but a lot of people go on the same journey. They go on the same thing where I think people could be taught this stuff ahead of time, where you get excited about an idea, you put it out, you're going to burn out if you haven't thought about sustainability. You're going to burn out because you're going to feel obligated to close issues or answer people's questions when you don't really understand that like there's a difference in these kinds of things. All the stuff that we've learned, that anyone doing open source for a significant number of years have learned about a healthy way to deal with this stuff. And so understanding that stuff and those practices and is something that could be taught, I think, you know? And so I don't necessarily think it's inherent in open source. I think there's like, I think the tooling could be better. Like GitHub could do a better job with this stuff. But like the stop energy concept definitely like feeds into it, you know?
Yeah.
Definitely feeds into it. And like, there's just a lot here. Like there's your personality and how you take criticism and, how you take input from people. And again, if it's someone with zero stake, but they are dropping comments and your personality is in such a way that you react to it, that can be a form of stop energy that can be really bad for the project. And you don't really understand why it is, or you don't know it because you're new and you haven't learned about this stuff yet. You know,
thinking about it as how it could be taught is super interesting, right? Like I have no idea what that would look like other than like listening to like people talk about it.
Conference talks of people talking about like going through burnout and then what they did to like fix it and like healthy barriers and all that kind of stuff. I think that is helpful. I mean, I certainly have learned a lot, you know, from listening to others and also going through stuff on my own, but I feel like I avoided a lot of the problems by listening to people. It's definitely hard. Certainly like, I mean, work can be hard too. Like you can get a bad job with bad boundaries and bosses that ask you to work late. And until you understand that about yourself, you'll fall into those things. But you can get a good job where people go home at 5 or whatever, and you don't have to flex that muscle as much. But it's true that in open source, there's basically nothing there inherent in a lot of the system that, in fact, most of the incentives in GitHub and everything are working against you. They're working to keep you pushing past those boundaries.
So true. Your workplace actually has a healthy way incentive better to send you home at 5 o'clock every day.
Yeah. So exactly. Pretty interesting. Yeah. Yeah. You know, prioritization, all this stuff that we've talked about before. It's all kind of related. Man, you've been working with Amplify, huh? What is Amplify again?
Yeah.
AWS services?
Yeah, 50 AWS services brought into one. It is their, I don't know, can I describe it like, it's like their version of Firebase, where you can write a full stack app, you know, having only a front end application. So you can configure everything from the front end. You configure everything from the front end, but you have the full stack, everything from, you know, GraphQL database. To database, to authentication, to file uploads, to
file uploads
functions. Yeah. File uploads. Amazing. Wait,
like WordPress_upload.php.
Yeah. Well, you just manage that. It's kind of, you were making fun of file uploads, but it's like interesting to think about, like you're doing file uploads from your front end. Like,
yeah. How does that work?
They basically give you a CLI to configure everything. There's a UI, but you know, it's AWS UI.
Yeah.
The CLI is good though. CLI is good. It's great. It's great to have a full stack app and only have a React code base.
Do you have, like, when you configure this thing in the CLI, you're saying do you have to set up a S3 bucket and stuff like that?
So the Amplify basically does all that for you. That's like the idea behind Amplify is marrying all of these services together, right? You could build all this without Amplify. It would take you like 50 years,
but you could
like set up each individual AWS service. I think there is some stuff in Amplify isn't just the wiring. There's also some other stuff they provide. Yeah. But they make it so you don't have to think about S3 or DynamoDB. Now, these things like are implementation details, and they do leak. You do need to know about Dynamo, but for the most part, you can probably get pretty far without ever thinking about it.
Wait, can you walk me through this file upload thing? You're saying you don't have to like write a signatures controller or whatever?
Yeah, there's no backend, right? So you're not.
There is no server.
Yeah, exactly. You install their JavaScript library and you import it, and you would call something like file.upload and pass it a file input, and I see. Makes sure that you know that your app itself is built with like access to your Amplify instance.
I see.
And then users, like you have a way for users to log in, so you can control like who has access to upload. I can say like only admins can upload and so on.
It's pretty cool. I mean, overall, it's easier than like when we added file upload to EmberMap admin.
Yeah, I mean you end up
with less code.
Yes, there's no backend, so it's like you get rid of that liability for sure.
That's good. That's kind of what we talked about last time.
Right, right. The second Amplify app you make is way better than the first. Right?
Yeah,
just because you've learned everything.
Yeah.
The surface area of this is just massive. I think I've talked about this before, but they have everything, and so.
Like Elasticsearch, basically, right? I mean,
you know, I don't know if they have search. It's funny. They have, I mean, they just have so many different things. It's not like, you know how like oftentimes when we're working on something, we're like very intentional about like our product decisions. Like we have kind of like a story, a path that you follow.
Yeah.
This just feels like.
The opposite.
It feels like throwing paint at the wall and like here are 5,000 APIs and you can build anything you want. But it's just massive. I mean, it's massive.
Interesting.
So yeah, there's a lot. There's just really big projects like this. There are often more things that come up than a single documentation site can cover. And so you have to get good about like going through GitHub issues, asking questions. Yeah, so that's what I mean when I say like the second app is always easier than the first.
Yeah.
Because that first app is going to be like, listen, if I was writing a Rails controller, I would know it would be one line of code. I would know exactly what to do. And so,
right. Right.
Yeah.
That makes sense. I mean, that feels like the experience I had with like Hasura, where I love what I ended up with, but the first time to get there, it took a week of reading and understanding, and then you understand how it works together, and then it takes like 2 seconds the next time you do it, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I'm
you're building an app with an Amplify app.
Yeah.
Is it a React app and then an Amplify thing, or is it one code base? What is it?
It's one code base, a Next.js app.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, one code base.
Do you have to use Next with Amplify, or can you use anything?
You can use anything. I mean, this is again where it's like massive surface area, so like you open up the Amplify docs and it's like JavaScript, React, Angular, TypeScript, iOS, Android. So the idea is it's like a front end. It's a full stack app where you only maintain the front end code base.
I see.
So you can like think about what that actually means. That applies to like Android apps as well as React apps.
I see.
So it works. It works. Their docs aren't specific to Next.js, and there's you know, Next.js by like default does all this server-side rendering stuff, so you kind of have to figure that out when you encounter something that doesn't work in SSR mode.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, you know, just the React docs are enough for any Next.js user to understand how to piece things together.
Got you. What do you think about Dynamo, dude? I was listening to another podcast about it, and the guy was talking about it and saying, like, the person was like, basically, you know, the last person we had to talk on about Dynamo was like, yeah, Dynamo's not good for every situation. It's good for these, but not these. There's no silver bullet or whatever. And then this guy was saying like, no, everything is going to use Dynamo in the future. And like anyone who's doing relational needs to unlearn it and like learn how to think in terms of this and blah, 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 you know?
Yeah. So I mean,
because it scales so well, you know, basically was his point, but
Yeah. I don't have scaling problems, right? Like I've had problems with like SQL queries that need to be optimized, but I don't have really scaling problems.
I wonder if that's what he was talking about though.
Well, I look at Dynamo as an implementation detail. If they told me this thing was using Postgres, I would be perfectly fine.
Your code wouldn't look any different, basically.
I've had to learn some stuff about Dynamo. Like that's the implementation detail leaking. Mm-hmm. But yeah, for the most part, my code would look the same. The way my mental model of how the code works, like you don't have to forget everything you know about relationships. That's actually kind of ridiculous. Like in you can have a post, a tag, and a post tag model in Dynamo. So that
it's more about, he was saying you have to know your access patterns and you don't want to wait too long designing like your schema or your database layout without thinking about the access patterns of your app.
That is one of the things that I hit really early, where you can't just query for things. You have to describe what you want to query for. But doing that is actually really easy, and it's not like some huge burden. I just say that, like, okay, I want to be able to query comments by their date, and I can just add a little decorator to my GraphQL schema, and boom, it's done. So, this is where, like, I would say, like, yeah, I think a Dynamo here is just an implementation detail. But there is stuff you have to learn. And also, too, when you're using Amplify and you're like, okay, I want to see my data, like I just created a whole bunch of records, like you are going to, the easiest way to see your data is through the DynamoDB interface. So you end up, just learning that and clicking around.
Right. Pretty interesting. And that's all hosted on Amazon and everything?
Oh, yeah. Yep. All Amazon.
That's cool. So you configure your data through code. You were saying, like, your app code, like you have a schema that describes like a post that has a title and an author and everything.
Yep.
As opposed to Hasura, where we jump into that, like the UI and like create a table there. And like, our front end doesn't have any notion of like our Hasura schema or whatever.
Yeah. So you configure all this through a GraphQL file, and then you basically use a CLI to generate all the front end code. So you can import queries and models and there's a couple different ways you can access that data. And then you also use the CLI to basically set up those tables, for lack of a better word, on the back end, right? Mm-hmm. So once you write that GraphQL file, like you might need to, they don't really say this, but you can think of it like a migration, right? If I have a post and I add a new field, I then use the CLI to sync that.
You like that? How do you think it compares to like the Hasura model? Which do you like better?
I don't really have a lot. I just built like a little toy app with Hasura, so I don't have a ton of experience. I mean, I like it. It's easy. I haven't run into any problems. It's interesting. Like when I work on Rails apps, you eventually hit a point where you have to do like a really big refactor, like completely change the domain model, start moving data around. And I haven't done anything like that with Amplify, and I'm sure it's doable, but it's the question of, how much am I going to hate my life while I'm doing it. So it will be interesting to see what my take is when I hit that point.
Yeah. I did do like a migration in Hasura that I hadn't done before. That was interesting. It's because we added the feature to the sandboxes. So Mirage REPL, we had created a sandbox model that has a config, and you can save it. And then I wanted to go back and add URL method and request body as new fields so that you can share those on a sandbox. And so that was like a migration, right? It was like modifying a table and adding columns, and it was pretty easy. You just push a button basically, but there's implications, right? Because you have these permissions set up. So you have like, an admin can do everything, and then an anonymous user has like these few things it can do. So then you realize you have to basically give the anonymous user access to these new fields that you have. But like, as far as migrations go, compared to writing something in Rails, it was pretty awesome. I mean, it all just kind of works.
Yeah.
And there was like a constraint, like a thing with a key where, what was that? Maybe I renamed the key. Why did I do that? I like renamed the ID. Oh, we changed it from a UUID to an integer. That was the thing. So we had the table that had an ID field that was a UUID, was the primary key. And then so I had to like create an IDD field that was an integer and then default it to auto increment, which I was able to do. You create that and all the existing rows got an int. And then I made it the primary key, deleted the original one, and then renamed it from like IDD to ID, something like that, you know? But every step I was basically clicking it. It's kind of like, you can imagine, obviously, if it was a, this is the kind of thing where if it was a more complex app with a lot of existing data and more complex models, you'd want to write the migration, maybe even write tests, you know, to make sure that the data migrates correctly. And so,
or at least like migrate locally and then
query
your data and, you know,
see if you broke constraints or anything like that. So that was kind of that was the first time where I was like, oh yeah, this worked out fine for me, but it might be a little weird to not really to not have the source of truth like represented in code alongside my app. It's just lives in Hasura, you know, on its own. So there's a lot of nice things about that because I just, it's just nothing to maintain, but you could imagine it causing problems at some point or you wanting that. So I wonder if there's escape hatches there, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I guess that's one of the things like I like about Amplify is that, you know, it's all in your front end code base. So there's Git history of all that stuff.
Right.
It's code. I mean, even if it's like a weird syntax, it's still code.
Right. But it feels like you're not writing tests against it. So it's not like, it's not liability in the same way that Rails code is, right?
Oh, yeah, of course. And you're not, I mean, I'm not hosting anything. I don't, there's no ops. There's absolutely no ops.
No, I know. But if you were adding permissions to it that got complex, you could imagine getting to a point where you want to write tests for it, right?
Yeah, that's actually a really good question. Point is that I don't know. I mean, it's all like declarative API for this.
Yeah.
And I if I ever got to that point, I would probably want to write tests, and I don't know if I would know how to do that.
Yeah.
You know, they give you some tools, like you can run a mock server that like runs like a Dynamo instance on your computer and gives you graphical to query it. It'd be interesting to see like how, like what does that look like when I get really, really complex stuff and can I get testing artifacts in the code base?
Right. Interesting. What app are you working on?
I am making a book tracker for books I read. And the thing I'm adding now is recommendations. So people recommend books. And the problem with book recommendations is you need to know the person that recommended it to you.
Yeah.
Because a year from now, when you go to read that book and it's awful, it'll be like...
Yeah, you're gonna add a ranking algorithm to all your recommenders. Yeah. So like, if Sam recommends a book, it automatically goes to the bottom of the list or whatever because all of his last recommendations were bad. Yeah. No, I want to actually make the same thing. I was actually gonna start designing something for movies as a watch list, like a My Watch List app that has that, and like, it's the same thing. The critical piece is like who recommended this, but I think it would be fun to put it out there and to see if people would be interested in learning how to build it. And I could do it either as like a one day build on like YouTube, which I think would be fun.
Yeah.
Or, you know, we've been talking about brainstorming a course for Next.js. So that would be another fun one to do. And like, you could make it, what would be cool about the watch list app would be like, cause it's movie posters and TV posters would be the primary. It's always great when you have a lot of artwork that is like the primary driver of a site because it makes it really beautiful and you just let that stand out. So you have it like a really black background and you have the artwork stand out. You could do some cool transitions, stuff like that, you
know? Absolutely.
I think it'd be fun.
And you know, going back to like the Amplify stuff, this has been, it's like a simple domain model, right? Like books, people, reviews, ratings. So everything is like, the join tables are simple, everything's just really, you know, that's why I'm able to think of Dynamo is just an implementation detail because I can define my GraphQL schema and everything just works.
Right. Nice. Cool, man. Well, I want to hear more about Dynamo. I want to hear updates next week, see where you get, because it sounds cool. Hasura is cool so far. My next little side project is going to be, I've been doing this work journal on my site, and every time at the end of the week, I want to update it. I pulled my code base and I wrote some React components that are like entry for, you know, date and then like entry dot item, you know. And so it's pretty, it's almost like MDX kind of thing. It's pretty easy to write in it, but it's still a little annoying to open the code editor and copy that JSX and like run serve and see it and then like, you know, push it and all this stuff. It'd be cool. It'd be a cool little part of the site to have it be generated at runtime so I could make a little UI for like adding entries. I also want to eventually have a newsletter just to send out updates of it every week. Because some people have expressed interest in that for some reason. So I think it'd be cool to do that. And I was thinking about how to do that.
Dude, you should look at
Substack. First, I want to change my site from a Gatsby site to Next App.
Yeah. I know you want to build this. Substack is kind of made for this.
What is Substack?
It's a publication thing that you subscribe to. So it's like Medium, but people can subscribe so they can enter their email address and get notifications. But then the main thing here is that authors can charge per thing. So a subscription can cost, you know, $15 a month. And then when I publish things, they can be either free or to subscribers.
Very cool.
For something like your work journal where it's, you know, bullet points and links, this would be perfect. It's unfortunately it's made for kind of you know, like your typical like Medium author.
Yeah.
And it's not made for developers, so like code samples are really hard. Like no syntax highlighting, so it's just not made for developers. But for something like the work journal, it might be really good. And the fact that they just handle the email list for you, and I mean, that stuff is just great.
That's pretty cool. Because I didn't want to do ConvertKit because I don't really like it. So I wanted to try something else.
Think about ConvertKit is great for an email list, but then every time you write a work journal, you've just added 30 more minutes onto it because now you got to go copy it over to ConvertKit, send a test email.
Yeah. I really want to like log into my site, go to like / work journal and have like an admin button or whatever and just, you know, just right there. And then it basically, ideally, if I snap my fingers, you know, it publishes to my site. It like tweets out a thing that looks the same and has the update.
Yeah.
And then it sends an email out, you know, like automatically.
I mean, yeah, Substack, this is Substack.
But how can I get the content from Substack onto my site?
Well, you would use Substack for the whole thing. So there would be, it would get you 90% of the way there. But like, yeah, I know you like to take a screenshot of your post and tweet that out. Where like Substack wouldn't do that. Substack would just tweet out new work journal added and here's a link. So you would lose those little touches. Mm-hmm. So
what about getting it onto like samsolkoff.com/workjournal? The content lives in Substack, right?
You wouldn't be able to do that. It's all hosted by them. I think with like some really big publications, they have more of the ability to customize. For you know, you and I, the little guys. No, it would all live with them. So that's what I mean. Like it would get you, it wouldn't get you 100% of the way there. There'd be a lot of little details that bug you. But
yeah,
it would get you 80-90% there.
Totally. I totally see the argument. If I was actually, my goal was to start like a newsletter or like my goal was to start a paid newsletter. Right now, my goal is not even to email it. It's just actually, the only problem I want to solve is how to make it easier for me to update my journal. And I think it'd be good to take it as an opportunity to learn how to integrate, you know, more practice with like a serverless function into a static Jamstack site, like my website. So what would it look like? And I would be okay with it being at runtime. I don't need it to be server rendered. It would be easier to not have to redeploy it when I update it. I update it once a week. Why do I want to redeploy my site? I don't know. At least for a preview workflow, I would really like to be able to preview it. This would be ideal. I can go and type into an interface and see it because I like to see it in the final form, because that influence, you know, it's just, I like to see that as I'm writing.
Yep.
So, but I don't want to have to start a local dev server to do that.
Or if you're doing it in production, you don't want to have to redeploy every time you click the save button.
Exactly. Or someone today found a typo. So I want to just be able to change that and not have to redeploy. Right. So I think I would start with just runtime generated, and maybe SSR could be like a further optimization. Like once a journal is like a week old, then you can SSR it. Right. But like the latest journal update would just be client side. So the build part would be like a shell. That'd be fine. And then it loads it from somewhere. Right. So it loads it from Hasura or something. Right. And then, and that's it. It's just a runtime thing.
Yeah. Plus the servers that you're adding.
What do you mean?
Now you got to set up Hasura.
That's a button press. That's great.
You
that's fine.
You have to manage it. Yeah. And then in a year from now, when you get an email from Heroku saying that they're upgrading their stack, and you got to
deal
with
it. Well, what about, I could fetch it from GitHub comments. You know, I could do that thing that I did. No, I want a backend though.
Yeah.
I want to build an app that has persistence. So what am I going to use?
I like the service idea, like what Firebase, Amplify. Yeah,
sure, you know. Sure. I mean, Hasura Cloud.
Yeah. Yeah, if you could get a Hasura instance that there's, yes.
No,
you don't have to manage.
I haven't had to manage Hasura yet. So, you know, I know you have those battle scars. I don't have those battle scars. I reroute all those notifications to Ryan Doe at gmail.com.
I draw a hard line in the sand of, you know, do I have access to modify this container?
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's good. So Hasura Cloud will be one thing.
I mean, that would be super cool.
Yeah. Firebase is pretty neat that it's real time. I mean, that seems pretty awesome. So maybe I would use Firebase.
Yeah. You know? Yep.
But I think it'd be really cool to be able to have that. And just also like, as I'm going through the week, I'm making notes of interesting things or the work I'm doing, and I'm just using a notes app. It would be cool if I could just use my app and queue it up and create a draft and just drop them there as they come up and just make a super clean interface that lets me do that. And then at the end of the week, I just get to hit publish and it just takes care of it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So that would be a fun little side project to get some experience, more experience with the serverless stuff with. So we'll see. That'd be fun though.
Yeah, it'd be interesting too, like to see what the, you know, you want to add email. So then yeah.
That's the other thing is like, ideally the goal is to build a habit where it does it every week. So again, if I could snap my fingers, I would just have something where I'm able to push it as I, you know, oh, this was interesting. Just drop, put it right into the journal. And then like every Sunday, it just emails whatever's in there and cuts it off and that's it, you know? And it just automatically emails whatever's in my journal from the last week, basically.
Oh, cool.
You know?
And yeah, auto-publish.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Because it's just all there and the format's the same. It's just a super simple format that's the same, you know? Mm-hmm. So that'd be pretty cool. And so I think that would be like one of those cron jobs as a service things, I guess, or some integration, serverless integration with, I don't know, Firebase Action or something that sends a message to MailChimp. You know, who knows what that is, but it'd be fun to go through that.
Yeah.
But I want to solve my problem. So that would be an eventual thing, but then eventually it would, how do I get sign up on here without using ConvertKit, you know, with using something. Maybe ConvertKit ends up being the best thing, but I just didn't like it when I had to use it. So yeah, pretty interesting.
It's so funny, man. As you're describing this, I'm like, AWS has literally every feature that you're talking about, but
it would take a lot to learn.
Yeah, it's just not, the tooling just isn't there from a
DX standpoint.
Yeah, exactly. It's just you have to have all the knowledge of all the services and yeah, it is not that product feel of click here, connect these things. So,
Interesting. One thing at a time. We'll see where it ends up.
Yeah.
I'll have 10 services to have a single sign up field. Cool. Shall we wrap it?
Yes.
That was fun, man. Keep on amplifying. I really do want to, you have to show me some of that code soon. I'm interested in it.
Yeah.
And then we can just pray they'll hire a product and person and a UI team one of these days.
Man, it's yeah, it is. It's like I'm, you know, I'm on the fence about a lot of it, but I think it's close. I mean, I you know, I see
there's a lot of power there.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, just not
too much power.
Not maintaining your own servers is a really powerful idea. And yeah. I'm willing to put up with a lot of front end debt because, just a lot.
Interesting.
Because maintaining server sucks.
Interesting. Cool. All right, everyone. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week. Bye.